First of all, let me have my disclaimer. This discussion is not in any political belief, religious, identity, sexual acknowledgement. This is merely for the discussion of Jedi and for those that wish to improve their lives. Any other discussion that deviates from that, that will cause controversy, shall be warned once, and if again persists, shall be asked to leave. Thank you very much. I'm Tal Griffin, and with us today is always an enjoyable conversation of Miles, and I forget your last name, I'm sorry.
Robinson.
Miles Robinson, thank you. And as normal, Julie and myself, Tal. So the topic we're discussing.
Also, Xenon's here.
Okay, great. And we'll have Xenon in the room too. Great. So the topic today is our experience, beliefs, perception, and value. And I think it might hold some very interesting topics and discussion today. And I'm going to let Miles Robinson have the floor mainly today, since he's the guest. And so, Miles, if you don't mind.
Well, first off, thanks for having me on, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk with you guys today. So thank you for that. So let's set up some kind of framework for this conversation.
Sure.
So perception versus belief, and there's experience. Basically, when we talk about experiences, we talk about perception. We're talking about the interactions that we witness and the memory of them. That's basically the sum of experience. And we can make a lot of associations of how that experience comes to be and what that experience means. So experience versus belief, or in other words, perception, observable perception versus belief. So observable perception, those are the things that we can see, we can reproduce, we can observe, it's great, we can measure, we can reliably reproduce in experimentation. This is the realm of science. It's basically the premise behind the scientific method is right. That we can observe the world and we can repeat those observations. When we can repeat those observations in neutral ways, we can make inferences about how the world works and we can understand it in a deeper level. Belief, on the other hand, is something that is not observable. It's something that we associate to be true, we hold to be true, but we can't actually observe it explicitly, because if we can observe it explicitly, it's no longer belief, it's just observable fact. So if I drop an object and it hits the ground and I observe that this is something that I can do 1,000 times out of 1,000 and it always happens exactly the same way, I observe this anomaly of gravity. That's an observable fact. Now, how did gravity get there? Well, I may have any number of explanations that range anywhere from, well, there's a bunch of electromagnetic fields or other things, various things, or perhaps some cosmic aliens built a system that made it this way, or it was intelligent design, or some other conceived theory or possibility of how this would manifest itself, how it would result and come in to be true. But we can't observe it. We can't see it in action. We can't observe it. We just make this philosophical association and say that it's meaningful for me that I have this philosophical association, even though I can't observe whether it's true or not. Right. So belief is the unobservable truth, and we have the observable truth. Where these things come together is in our association of value. And value is an association of the meaningfulness of both the belief and the observation in conjunction, in combination. Yeah. And so we can associate these two things together and say, all right, so if I'm going to take action on something with all of my observable activities, I know how to take action in the world, I know how to lift weights. I know how to build a house. I know how to write a paper. I know how to do these observable interactions in the world. And I can do it from a place of what I believe is meaningful and valuable.
Yes.
Then perhaps I could produce something that ends up being valuable and of worth. So I think that that's kind of the framework where I just want to kind of baseline on. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah. See, and you touched on something there that our observations, I think in a way, we can will in a way alter or can help shape our perception on things. And that would you think that that is where the belief and the value of that comes from our experiences that we gather?
I think our interaction with the world informs our belief system as far as either validates it, reinforces it, or invalidates it. If I have a belief system, the flying spaghetti monster is going to come to my house on Thursday, and Thursday happens, and no flying spaghetti monster shows up, I invalidated that belief. So there is, you know, I think that that belief needs to incorporate observation and perception. It needs to incorporate that explicitly. And if you have beliefs that are contrary to what you observe, perhaps there's a good opportunity to try to find a way to reconcile that. And the need to reconcile that is a probably good measure of how to interact with a belief.
Yeah. So I know that each of us has, from what I've seen and myself, as we go throughout our day, there is always going to be a core value and core belief that we always go with, you know, and that is, I think, ultimately, when we make decisions for the future, have a role in that, play a part in that decision. And regardless on how we vote, what organization, what affiliation or group or organization we may be with, I think that anything that may align with that, our values, our beliefs, and the experiences with that, and the alignment of that, play a big role in that. But you made a point about the flying spaghetti monster showing up for dinner, okay, on Friday. Well, you've just proved that belief that the spaghetti monster isn't going to show up for dinner. So, and that something that is non-witnessed, because there are so many followings of things that belief on something that is non-witnessed per se, okay?
By definition, my earlier comment, a belief exists where we cannot observe the truth of it.
Yes, yeah. And I think, would you think that influences from others' beliefs do affect our perception with that?
I think there are a couple things here. One is, first, the origin of beliefs. Where do they come from?
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain portion of it that is intuitive and therefore possibly, you know, genetically oriented.
Yeah.
There are, of course, primal motivations for decisions that are of value, and those rely on some form of notion of right action under certain circumstances. There's also our cultural upbringing. So
That I would greatly agree with. Because there'll be some families and upbringings that are more productive physical output and the results of that physical labor, the results of being a hunter, being a layman, a carpenter, being a metal worker. Those have a way of how we think. If someone's primarily a hunter and came from a hunting background, they're going to always look into that more basic part of ourselves, the survival type instincts that we have of how can I best feed my family and what do I need to do in order to make that happen, the actual physical productivity, the results, and that be the goal orient. And to that person, the value is what the results are. What is my take here? The value in the building of the house, that skill, and the results of that labor that goes into it. And whereas somebody who is corporate oriented and minded, their bottom line, their end result is going to go, what is going to yield in the goal financially, help raise stocks, or what is going to help raise our commercial market value to where we get more of, to where we get more of this percentages, so the stock market is better for us, so we gain profitability financially for it, and that the person that helped us get there is valuable, and that's valuable experience in order and gained for either one of those people, depending on how one was raised, as you were saying. And that, and I think our perceptions go with that and the experience that goes with it. So, and we base what we do from experiences we've had, which shape our beliefs. Now, the belief, you made an interesting statement there. Beliefs are only non-observed. It's other than what we've witnessed. Now, a moment ago, my cat jumped up in front of the screen. So we observed and witnessed the cat jumped in front of the screen. Do I have an annoying cat? Well, that's kind of a belief. But when we see that, yes, he has an annoying cat. We've witnessed it. It is true. And that, I think, is the difference because with the corporate that is driven by stock market, you've seen that. And there's value in that. However, if someone has only theory, that's still only a belief that this is. If I'm understanding you correctly here.
Yeah, so you're very close. There's a portion of belief that comes from genetics. It's just, it comes hardwired in the system. So
Yes.
there's a core set of that. There's a core value system and a core set of these are the right actions that live there. We compensate, reconcile, and modify those with cultural upbringing as you grow up. It's one of the responsibilities of your parents is to help shape a additional set of values and And they're going to be based on belief to begin with, because you have no witness. You're taking it at your educator's word that this is valuable.
Yes.
So until you can witness it, it's a belief. But then you start to, when you become an adult, you start engaging in the world. As you begin to take action and see the consequences of those actions, then you start to become the witness. And as you become the witness, your beliefs continue to evolve, modify, grow, change, shift to accommodate the new reality. In some cases, the belief just goes away because you've now witnessed it to be fact. It's no longer belief, it's now fact. That's one case. But another one is, oh, this belief needs to be modified a little bit, because as I understood that belief as a child, I now witnessed it in a more nuanced and complicated way as an adult. And so now my child's understanding now needs to be refined.
One thing I keep thinking back on is that when I was growing up, my dad would say, my job is to prepare you. Okay. And when we're younger, sometimes what he believes and what's valuable to him at the time may not be of the same value, because we're in two different realities. We're in two different stages in our lives. However, I am learning and seeing that the beliefs that are valuable, because part of that is the gene pool that is carried over. So in some ways, some of those core beliefs and values and perspectives are going to have an effect on how one thinks, how one acts, and what their beliefs are. Now, is that going to be the whole defining aspect? No, because we're still two different people. We still do have two different minds. But some of those traits that are passed down still hold and resonate in what was taught to us, simply because of part of that gene pool that was passed down. And that though beliefs are going to be different, and that my dad was a believed in a different religious belief than I do, and it was very beneficial to him, and that was a value, and it helped his perception to him. Now, he and I took different paths, but yet our principles, I think, aligned in many ways. And I think the value, as I've gotten older, that he worked to teach me still play that part. To me, once I've chopped down a tree with a chainsaw and I chop it up with firewood, that is very valuable. And there's benefit in that, because the finished labor, the job accomplished, and the belief in that hard work pays dividends. And with that, I think there is something very much to be said about the upbringing, the genetics, and the alignment, and that there are still a same belief in that. Now, the perception of it is the understanding that comes later, once we mature to see eye to eye with what they were trying to teach us as we grow up. And our experiences gain some of the same lessons. If I'm understanding this greater, or this more greatly, as I get more into his age of where he was, when I started to get more of an understanding of that. Because at 20, 25 years old, 30 years old, those really aren't your priorities. There are other things that are still influencing the drive. Because at that age, we're hopefully looking, you know, to get married, to have offspring, to get into that house, all these other things to get set. And our beliefs drive us in those decisions we make with that. What's your take on this, Julie?
So, Julie, you were going to say.
Well, I was thinking that when people are in chaotic environments, usually they'll form like a belief for coping with said chaotic environment. Mm-hmm. So in that way, a lot of the in what's around us, our environment, beliefs can help us adapt to said environments and can be formed by that experience.
Yeah, the beliefs are going to be modified and pivot and shift as we develop. And to your point, you know, if you're dealing in a chaotic environment where safety is not guaranteed, and a belief that safety is never 100% available, or you don't understand what a safe environment looks like or would be like, then your set of beliefs around how the world operates are going to be very focused on, you know, preservation of self and those that you care about. It's going to be very focused on how to maximize or how to minimize risk and maximize survivability, for example. There's a couple of archetypes in various systems that exist that are the manifestation of that. One of them is the notion of an orphan child would have a belief system that is very different than someone who was raised in a different orientation. So yes, absolutely. But I think the core part that's important about it is to acknowledge that we are where we are because of all that we have been taught and all that we have seen, and the consequence and the consequences that were there. But then there's also the recognition that, and all of this could be 100% wrong, and it needs to be able to be overridden. We need to be able to be willing to be wrong. And sometimes it's going to take a lot of, depending on how much risk is involved in the adherence to the belief, some of that's going to take some real doing. There are going to be higher and higher bars. One of my favorites is a commentary that had came out. It's like, you know, I was at age 16, I knew everything. And at 17, I knew more. And at 20, I found out, actually, really, now I know everything. And at 26, I found out, oh, I didn't know anything. And that old man that was telling me I didn't know anything was probably more right. And so, and now at 30, it's like, oh, well, it doesn't even matter if I knew anything or not. My life is an entirely different scenario. So this ability to have beliefs that can be challenged, that can be questioned and can be evaluated so that they can be reinforced when they are, when they're still valuable, and that they can be modified when they turn out to be either refuted or they turn out to be less valuable or even in some cases harmful. Some contexts, some beliefs in some contexts are actually destructive. So we need to be able to be fluid in that and accept that in any moment we should absolutely believe and be of great conviction in our beliefs and always have the ability to be wrong. that combination is very difficult to maintain.
Yeah. The one thing you were saying that I think is in many ways is I think undeniably true, that when we're 20, 30 years old and 16, well, in 16, we think we know everything. Okay. And then when we turn 40 or even in our 50s, what we believe then is absolutely incorrect. And that, yes, that old man was right. And so I think based on what somebody's experiences are, reveal instead of a belief, a truth in something. That when they say, for example, they're going to be a rather crude example, but I think it holds a relevance to this, is when we're that age, up to a certain age, we're only concerned about the biological pursuit of a mate, ideally, and that that's going to set us up later for down the road. And that if that works out and one is successful, once one has a family and a wife or a spouse, then the beliefs we had are going to change. And we're going to no longer stay in that frame of mind of where we were because of what now we hold valuable to us and the importance and the priority. And I think that has a way of causing us to adjust our beliefs because of what now becomes the main objective for us to do. You know, I think where we go into the stage of life, as you were saying, Miles, our beliefs do change. Our core values change. But I think in a way, there is still that underlying hard core beliefs that as we grow older, instinctually still play a part in where we go with things. And the mistakes and the lessons we learn, the experiences we gain, either reinforce that or prove that what we thought were incorrect. And we have to change accordingly. We have to adjust. So what may be valued by me at my age aren't going to exactly be as of the same value as to Julie or even to you, but yet become more productive as we apply them and stay in alignment with that. Your thoughts?
I think that assumes that people are always interested in improving and refining and developing their belief system. And I think that sometimes that a lot of people don't do that actively.
Mm-hmm.
They just wander through life and let their belief system be a subconscious activity. And let the development of their belief system be subconscious. And it's perfectly fine. You can absolutely do that. But if you do it actively, if you actively explore, if you actively evaluate, if you actively engage and pursue in why do I believe the things I believe? Why do I value the things I value? Then, and with that willingness to be wrong, or that willingness to be the willingness for things not to be fixed, with the assumption that I know everything right now for all time.
Yeah.
But that I may learn something, that, I mean, there may be some things I'm ignorant to, and so I will make room for the knowledge instead of for the ignorance.
Yes.
Assuming that you are willing to make that change, I think that an active practice of identifying what your beliefs are and then operating within them so that you don't live as a hypocrite.
Yes. But
then also being willing to have them be modified by reality when disproven. I think one of the greatest growth moments in my life was when I had one of my beliefs shaken to its core by just observation of reality. Activities happened in my life, which meant that this belief that I didn't even know I was holding was just wrong. And I had built a huge amount of my understanding of the world on this belief. And now that belief's gone, what does that mean for all of the understanding? This is why betrayal is probably one of the most destructive activities emotionally. Because what is betrayal? But I believe that you are a trustworthy person. And I'm going to build a lot on that. I'm going to build our relationship. And then everything related that's reliant on that relationship being strong, the moment you betray my trust, now everything that relationship is built on is called into question. And needs to be reevaluated. And this is why betrayal is one of the big ones. Betrayal is one of the ones that cut us deeply and is one of those emotions that really does undermine the pinnings, not only of civilization and of law and order, but also of our own personal well-being and understanding of self. Because now there's this notion of, so this trust was wrong. Was I the fool? Should I have seen this all along? Is this, there's a lot of self-judgment that can come from that. There needs to be a lot of reconciliation of the truth. And so when you run into those situations, when you run into a case where a belief gets challenged in a positive sense, you get to grow. In a negative sense, it will undermine a lot of like things that you rely on in life as a stable platform for understanding how reality works. And when that gets shaken, well, now we have to rethink a lot of things. And if that happens to a core point or a core piece of your identity, or something you believe to be true about yourself is revealed to be wrong, like undeniably, absolutely, incontrovertibly wrong.
Right.
Well, now you have to redefine who you are.
Yeah.
And that takes time. That is a hard method. That took however many years you were getting up to the present before that moment happened to establish your current belief system. And now it's been demonstrated, part of it was incorrect. So you have to remake it. And I think it's a really valuable thing when it happens, but it sucks. Valuable, but it's a horror show internally.
Yes. Yeah. One thing that growing up with my last marriage I was in is that I had a romantic notion, very much of a romantic, okay, that everybody stays together, things shall be worked through, and that there is a solution. And love conquers all. Okay. Well, the betrayal of that, as you said, shakes somebody to the core. Everything that you based your work on, your efforts, are totally destroyed. And then you come in question of your own person, your own core values, your own core beliefs, whereas what one did to benefit the relationship hopefully ends up not working out and the doubt of, is it worth this? Now, today, after going through that experience of where are my values? What is valuable to me? Where does this other person add to my life? And what can be brought and built on that? I think now hold more value from that experience and the principles and perception than what happened, you know, 7 years ago. And it does cause one to change what their belief system is, what they go by, and the romantic sense and notions that I had, not so much anymore. As I'm older now, if I look back and think and know now, if I had been thinking in the mindset and frame of mind I have now, and if that person aligned with that instead of the more instinctual influences, would be vastly different. But yet, yes, is it painful? Oh, yes. Is it demoralizing? Yes. Is it greatly humbling? Yes. Was it bitter? Yes. And anybody who's ever experienced anything along those lines, I think in that you also redefine who you are as a person. And we will actually, in a way, and I hope I'm not wrong in saying this, redefine who we are. We redefine everything about who we are, what we are, which direction are we going to go now? What are we going to do? What focus are we going to have now to that? And I think there is a big responsibility to ourselves for that, and not sacrificing and compromising ourselves on that now. As bitter as that lesson was, and as hard as it was to swallow, it is inevitably, and I think in some ways undisputable, we have to go through that on occasion. Our world
loss is life. I mean, that's part of the deal. And the loss of the loss of a belief through disproven, through proven, you know, it's just wrong.
Yes,
is painful. I mean, it's some of the more painful kinds of loss. Some of those that you have to give up. It's like I mourn some of the losses on some of the beliefs that I held. Greatly, I had mourned them tremendously. There are there's another side to this though that has a lot brighter and cheery side to it, which is, and I find them the most interesting. And those are the beliefs that I hold, that I choose to hold, even though I know that there are exceptions or that they put me at risk.
Yes.
Because of the belief that the world and the interactions in it are better if I operate from this belief structure instead of that belief structure. And those are the ones that are the most interesting to me, and the ones that I find the most, where I find the most interesting value gets delivered from.
Yeah. And, you know, with any of it, we grow from this, right? We learn. And that is something that teaches us where these values, these perceptions, these beliefs do change. And when we actually witness the result of it, that shapes us as a person and can shape us in our core. Because there's something that I believe is a truth, is that in a way, and I'm probably going to say this wrong or quote it wrong, but I think the meaning is there, is that we ask in a way for our own suffering. If we keep ourselves in those situations. So we have a choice of where we stay and where, and when that decision that we need to make happens, do we stay and choose to suffer? Or do we choose the more productive way to end the suffering? And that when the betrayal happens, we learn more of the signals of, I have a real good feeling that this is getting ready to happen. But we base that from our experience that was very painful that we went through, which, even though there was pain involved, but then again, those that are Marine know this. Pain is weakness leaving the body. And in many ways, I think that applies even if we're not an active Marine or a former Marine or former active Marine.
I think when you're talking about physical pain under exercise duress, that's a cute phrase that works really well.
Yes.
I think when you start talking about psychological and emotional pain, or you start talking about joint pain, or you start talking about, I think that trying to make that a blanket statement, it may be a bit irresponsible.
Okay. Okay.
But it's particularly because we do so much to try to engage in ourselves emotionally. I mean, we experience emotions, we experience hurt, we experience love, we experience joy, we experience anger, we experience frustration, we experience helplessness, we experience empowerment, we experience euphoria. And these are visceral experiences that we have, and therefore they become part of our observations, they become part of our observed world. And we need to allow for the place where I am experiencing these emotional inputs. It's like, so that's one of those ways that we often have our beliefs restructured. It's mm-hmm. like, I believe in this thing. My emotions are telling me something else. Well, I need to reconcile these two. And I need to reconcile these two somehow. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, that gets reconciled by a restating of the belief or a reprioritization of a value, or a analysis and interaction with the emotion, or some combination of all of these. And when mm-hmm. we do that work, then does that bring us into harmony? No. But what it does is it takes us a bit out of ignorance, and it takes us to a place where I begin to understand. I think it's very important for us to understand what, I think it's very important for a person to understand what their values are. I think it's very important for a person to understand the frameworks of their beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so, and it doesn't matter, like, I'm not asking them to have beliefs that everyone else must agree with, but within their context, within their orientation of self, mm-hmm. I think it's a very important insight for someone to understand what beliefs and value systems are at play in them making their decisions, conscious and subconscious. And I think mm-hmm. that should be an explicit study. I think there's really value in that. I think that it's very difficult to do that when you don't have a lot of life experience.
Yes.
I also think it's very difficult to do that when you are in situations where you don't have a lot of freedom. Both of those conditions create a great deal of difficulty in your ability to be flexible and movable in the study. So mm-hmm. if you don't have a lot of freedom, take the case of an abusive relationship at the home. If you're a child, it's like, okay, you have no control over this situation. You need to figure out how to survive. Your opportunities of exploration are very small. Your opportunities for variation. If you're in a nation where you live in a totalitarian regime, your options for how you can freely express yourself or how you can freely explore this are very small. And so you don't, I mean, they come at actual consequence. So you may not have the means, the vehicle, you may not have the opportunity. And people, different people are going to have different contexts. If, however, you are in a position where you have some freedom to, you have some autonomy, you have some freedom, you have some ability to exercise your own individual will, then one of the things that becomes, I think, a really important and valuable lesson to understand is, okay, so now my will is my own. What is the best way I'm going to exercise it? What is, what are the principles and what are the, and in what context should I be operating in order to maximize the greatest benefit? And part of that in my belief structure, part of that becomes that, yes, some of that needs to be done for the self on an individual level, and then it needs to expand to others. And then it needs to expand to others that you know, and then it needs to expand to those you don't know. And it doesn't need to expand in identical ways across those audiences. Yeah. But it should be inclusive of that. And then with that framework, great. Now I have a pretty good idea of what I value and why.
Yeah.
And then as observations change those things, you can decide what parts of it need to be modified and how, and what course correction you need to do. I think this notion that you're ever going to have a core belief system that is absolutely true and you're going to be right the entire time, I think that's very aspirational. Probably not true, but I do think that at every moment you should operate as though you do have it figured out, and then allow for that volatility, allow for disruptions to allow you to change your mind. You're allowed to have different opinions in the future than you have right now. As one friend of mine says, I speak with absolute conviction with my beliefs lightly held. Meaning that any belief that he has in any moment, he's with absolute conviction, but those beliefs can modify very easily.
So would you say that, as it's said by some, that is that teachable moment? That is when, as a friend of mine said, when the master becomes the student moment, that's when I can be taught and change.
If we're going to use cool sayings, then I think the empty cup is probably more appropriate.
That one too.
When you get out of your own way, I mean, there's that. But from the way I experienced it was, I got hit in the face with a reality that was so outside of my belief structure and my orientation, but was so undeniably real that I had to go and remake myself.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Were you finished?
You're good.
Okay. Ahead. Now, there was something I watched. I think it was, and I'm not trying to name drop here or anything, or trying to push a YouTube channel when I say this. I think it was, okay, I'm just going to go with the example that was given here, that there was this young attorney and the interviewer on this podcast. Okay. He had two cups. Both were filled with water. And I think I used this in the last podcast, but I think it's very valid and very, very pertinent to where we are here, is that the full cup thing, that when someone's talking and laying and putting all this information out, right? And the person's cup is already full. they're not going to gain anything, right? Because we know everything, right? At 16, we know everything, so our cup is full. But then he goes, what happens when you empty the cup of the person that's getting told all this stuff? Okay. Then what happens with a person that starts asking questions? The cup is being emptied. I thought for a moment, I'm going, this is a great example of that. Empty your cup. That moment which we learn, we ask questions. And so we begin to refill and learn things that do challenge where we believe, what our values are, what our perception is. And we gain an experience that is valuable to us to go, I am able to still learn and not know everything. It's a very humbling moment when we can allow that to happen. You know, you were saying that there was this time in your life, you saw the world in one way. Okay. And that was an absolute for you at the time. And to a point, it may have proved to for as long and that as duration as it is or was, that was very valuable and held a definition for you. And I think for any of us, we go along and we have this belief that this is the way it is. Then something changes that. What we witness changes that. And that's where and when we get out of our own way, when we go, wait, hold, let's wipe the board clean. I need to step back.
If you do not hold the space in your mind to be wrong about what you believe, at least a little space, then when your beliefs are actually wrong, you won't have a choice. It will come, mm-hmm. it will break through regardless. Yeah. If you leave space for it, then you get to play in the game. You get to be part of it. And you get to modify it with less dramatic outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of extreme rhetoric in the world right now.
Yes.
A lot of statements where people are using absolute statements. Mm-hmm. And there are very few things when it comes to cultural realities, especially when you're talking about right or wrong. There are very few things that really are without tremendous numbers of qualifications, just absolute truth.
Yeah.
That's usually there's a nuance to many different angles, and often what these things are is their choices. There are choices in prioritization algorithms that we figure out. It's like, okay, mm-hmm. so given this condition, this condition, this condition, this condition, this condition, this condition, and under these places, and during this weather, and at this time, and at this age, and in this place, I choose to do this item over that item.
Uh-huh.
It's like, that's usually what the truth is.
Yeah.
And then what we're looking at is the outcome of the world is all these people making all of these decisions and how they interact with one another. And it's almost, it's ridiculously difficult to hold all that in your head. But it's much easier to take a position of generality and say, I hold this to be an absolute truth. And then we can go to war over it. It's easy. And because you're in deviation from my definition of this thing.
Uh-huh.
And if I now start saying that this is good and that is evil, then we start opening the room for I can devalue somebody else on the basis that they're evil. And
yeah.
I don't care which side of good and evil you're on. And do I believe that there is evil in the world? Absolutely. But I also know that there's a mechanism in the human mind that if it's activated, and it's somewhat belief oriented, that if it's activated, we have to guard against the devaluing of another individual, to the point where we no longer see them as being worthy of survival or being worthy of living. And yeah. When we get to that place, history has shown us that just turns out really bad, and whoever gets to the guns first is probably going to be the winner. So yeah. It's not, we don't want to be in that world. We don't want to exist in that state. That's a very dangerous place to be, and it changes reality very quickly and very abruptly. We'd much prefer to be in a nuanced but more complicated, more difficult, more hard to reconcile environment where, well, you and I are going to disagree, and we may have different belief structures, but we also have this underlying belief structure that we're not going to kill each other over it. And that's really, and I know that this is, people have criticized it takes me to extremes. Unfortunately, I have real life examples of I've borne witness to when it did go to that extreme. And mm-hmm. So I'm particularly sensitive to it. I'm particularly concerned about when people decide that's how that needs to go. So there's a need to be willing to engage in a back and forth, and be willing to be challenged, to be willing to have your beliefs and value structures challenged. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you have to change them, but you have to be willing to have them challenged without it being armed conflict.
Yeah.
If we have a vehicle for that, then great. We probably will get along much better. We'll probably do well. This is the whole notion behind a democratic system of government, in that we allow each person to vote of their own conscience, yes. Their own belief structure, their own thing. And then we'll kind of gather it all up and see what the whole thinks. And we'll try to go more with what people hold. And we recognize it's not going to be a perfect solution. And we recognize that perfection is not the goal. Good enough is the goal. And we hope that through this means, we can get to a place where we just have a bunch of good enough solutions that all work for the difficult conversations. For the easy conversations, it's not a problem. It's like, oh, look, 98% said yes. Well, it's a pretty easy solution. That 2% just have to deal with. But when we get into these cases where we're 4 or 5 points apart, we recognize that this is not an efficient system. This is not an easy system. It's not a highly functional system in these very complicated issues. Yeah. But it gives us a position to try to reconcile within that limited context. Now, in some way, without everybody going for the guns. And that's the thing we really got to keep an eye on.
Now, would you think that in what we've been talking about, that percentage does cause us to have to step back and reevaluate what our beliefs are, what our experiences were?
I think if somebody doesn't do that, that they're missing an opportunity to learn more about themselves. I have spent the last 5 months researching and studying subjects that I know nothing about, because they're not in my bubble of my feed. They're not in my algorithm. And so I have actively been I've been asking people who are in an algorithm that has been in opposition to some of my expressed opinions and ideas. And I have been going there with the approach of, I'm going to do my best to hold myself in this superposition, in this position of, my beliefs are not relevant to this conversation right now. I mm-hmm. want to understand their position from their strongest argument. In fact, I want to be able to make their position from their strongest position, in my opinion, as though that was my position. And then from there, if I hold all the positions that are in conflict with each other, and I want to analyze that, I can do that from the strongest position of all these opinions, whether I hold them or not, and then look at the situation there and try to find out what my choice is around the best way to handle the situation. This is ridiculously difficult. This is really, really hard. And it's stupidly hard because I have to get my information from wherever I can. I have to parse out the meaningful versus the unmeaningful. I have to parse out truth from rhetoric. I have to parse out all of the, I have to parse out a lot of things to try to do this. And in the process of doing this, I find that some of the things that I believed to be true were short-sighted. I won't say they were wrong, but they were short-sighted.
Okay.
And mm-hmm. so they needed a more nuanced explanation. They needed a more robust decision matrix.
Yeah.
So I needed to think through things in a different way. I needed to think through things in a more nuanced way. And mm-hmm. I find that really valuable. Now I get into this weird place where it's like, so what's your opinion? Depends.
Yeah.
Is really where it comes to right now. Now, this is why I should not be in charge of certain things.
Yeah.
Because if you want change, mm-hmm. and you want me to celebrate, you want me to change things just on the basis of change, and you want me to do it with great fervor and enthusiasm, I need direction to know where you want the change to go, because I establish directional outcomes. That's what I do for a living. That's my job.
Yes.
So I need the directional outcome. I don't think change is virtuous on and of itself. If you believe that change is virtuous in and of itself, then I may not be able to help you. But
yes.
I also think there's a tremendous amount of value on that, because those that do tend to hold that also hold great heroism and great hope for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And those are things that are highly valuable. And they end up with a great deal of conviction and passion and drive, which absolutely does change. If we can couple that with wisdom, that is a powerful force forward. The problem is, the things that give you wisdom kind of take away the heroism and the single-mindedness and the drive. So you end up sacrificing one to get the other, but you want both together to drive it forward. And if you can find a way to couple those, it's phenomenal.
I think wisdom in how I view most things is that wisdom invariably, in a lot of ways, will win out. And of course, everything we do, I'm sorry, my phone is not allowing camera for audio right now.
That's fine.
But I think that wisdom can tell us many things about who we are, and that wisdom, of course, is gained from the experiences that we've had, that we've learned from, and that helps us make the choices. Like you were saying, you need to know what the outcome is going to be in order to give you the direction you need to go to get that. I myself think very much along those lines, just simply because, to me, if it's simpler, more streamlined, and these steps are taken, then that's going to yield where I need to be, where what I'm doing needs to be, in order to have the most productivity, the value, and based on that, from the experiences that have happened, I think help play a very big part in that. In that, if we know which direction we are going, we know the steps we need to take in order to do it. And if two people are wanting the same end result, the same goal, but go about it differently, then I think that that harmony is what you're referring to. Now, and you were saying that your algorithm thinks in a different way, how you see it to make what you were doing to make it your algorithm do it. What is it you needed to do in order to allow yourself to have that open-mindedness to see things in this different way that challenged you to in your research?
I think that for me in this particular instance, I mean, I've done this several times. So the first time it was because I had to.
Yeah.
I had to in order to have certain, in order to get through a very tough time.
Yeah.
But now, I mean, in this particular instance, I have friends of mine in a lot of pain.
Yes.
And I wanted to understand the context. I want to understand the, I have friends who are in a lot of anxiety. Mm-hmm. And when I have friends that have a lot of anxiety, I, rather than ascribing it as a mental illness, my default reaction is that it is a perfectly rational and sane situation to, in relation to their belief system. Now, is that true? No, it's not. It's a chosen framework that I use because it's a chosen model that I use because it allows me to move forward in a functional way.
Yeah.
If I say that you're not mentally disabled because of anxiety, but you are anxious because of real world situations, there's a reason why you're anxious, then my exploration is, okay, so what's the source of the anxiety? And there's been with a lot of what we have going on now, particularly with social media and the way that communication is happening now in a lot of ways, it doesn't help keep things in a, I don't want to say rational, but in a balanced context. And so people can really rat hole into ways that are, no, absolutely, anybody in that position would be experiencing anxiousness. Yeah. And so it's like, yeah, no, I get it. And anxiousness at a certain level becomes physically debilitating. Absolutely. I've been there. So I'm interested in understanding that. But I also know that I'm not having any anxiety over the same discussion at all, regardless of what the context is. So I'm out of view of what's going on there. And so if I make the assumption that there is some very sane, rational, and absolutely understandable contributors to that fear, to that state of being, I should go and try to find them. And it's also very clear to me that I don't have access to them because I don't have that, I don't understand it. And my hope is that I don't say, because I don't understand, it doesn't exist. I never want to say that. I want to say, I don't understand. I would like to understand not so that I can fix it, but so that I can be compassionate in my reaction to you. And that I don't want to aggravate anything unnecessarily. Yeah. I don't want to aggravate anything out of ignorance.
Yeah.
I may help. I may not. It'll depend on the context, situation, and what's going on.
Uh-huh.
But at least I have never intended to make it worse for someone. I want to understand these things. So to understand these things, it means I have to go places where I'm not today. It means I have to go to places where I have never been. I have to go find data sources that are not in my world. And I have to go and actively seek them out. And sometimes that means I have to go find people that are not in the world that I live in, that hold belief systems very different, if not in complete opposition to my own, and go ask them, hey, what's the best source of information that you use? Uh-huh. And then go and study it, go and listen to it.
Yes.
And it shocks some of my friends that I I go and explore some of those ideas in the way that I do. And I try to do it respectfully with an open mind as best I can. Now, sometimes you run into a place where it's like, oh, yeah, this is just toxic. And this is not a good data source. But that's not very common. Usually it's a very good data source with disagreeing elements in it.
Yes, usually
it's like there are different choices being made for the same situation, or there are different opinions being held, and we recognize that these are opinions or choices, and that there are other choices that could be made or other opinions that could be held, and that these are the choices and opinions I'm making. Yeah. So when I get to those places, I really enjoy, honestly, I enjoy how much I learn from putting mm-hmm. myself in those places, because it means I get to learn different worldviews from the ones that I was raised, educated, and experienced.
Yeah.
And it's very foreign. I mean, it's uncomfortable a lot of the time. And I can only do it so often. I can only do it so frequently. Because it is uncomfortable to sit in the space of those that either, especially if it's in the space that your culture, your cultural understanding, your family or your upbringing or your traditions or your core beliefs are in absolute opposition with.
Yes.
It's hard to sit in that space and be like, no, I need to remain open to find out what the best possible position here actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't have to agree with it. I just need to understand it. And in many cases, what this does is it modifies my belief structure to include new nuances to take into account situations I hadn't considered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was an experience that I was in for a period of time that I looked at as, in a way, or I looked at my main purpose was to the more importance of a relationship versus actually what this person is doing, okay, and what this person believed about themselves, okay. And I think that the relationship and the belief in the relationship was more important, but in that I found that took me in a direction that was in many ways. And I think this is where we have to be careful when pursuing the understanding of it, that where we can keep ourselves at a distance and the compassion of it, of what the person is doing or what they're going through, where we have to remember that this isn't us. This isn't me. This is that. Okay. To stay detached from it, but still work to maintain that relationship with whatever it is and whomever it is. But in some ways, it can also be easy to let ourselves fall into, if we're not careful, into a belief system that is dangerous and damaging. And eventually, we question our own identity of who are we and what are we, and that when that happens, I think it's real important to stay in contact with the people that keep us grounded so we don't get lost, so we don't lose who we are as an individual. And when we do that, we are asking, when if we're not careful, for more harm than good to happen.
I think you're I'd probably take a couple of different tacks there. One of them is the most compassionate approach that I've ever had, that I try to go off of, is that phrase, "There but for the grace of God go I." Mm-hmm. The notion that when I see someone who is in a different condition than me, I recognize mm-hmm. that is me under different conditions. If my life had gone a different way, if different doors had opened, if other doors had closed, if different experiences had happened, if I'd been exposed to different things, that person who I either, you know, am feeling sorry for or being compassionate to or resisting or disliking or being angry with, it doesn't matter. Under different conditions, that is me. Under different conditions, that I would be doing the exact same thing they would. And that allows me to hold the space of you know, worrying about whether they're, you know, going to get me in trouble or not.
Yes.
The other piece is, I think that if you ever come into a situation where your beliefs get shaken, I think it's valuable. I think that's one of the most valuable things that can happen to you, because now if you just live in that space of, oh, I don't know what to believe anymore. Okay. That's harmful. That's unfortunately, that's a really, really painful way to be in life. Yeah. But if you take the opportunity to go back and go, okay, I need to reconcile this, and it's hard work. I'm not saying it's easy, but if you take that opportunity to go, okay, I need to get myself back to a place where I have a good understanding of what I believe and why.
Yeah.
Even if it's temporary, I have this position. And even though I know it's going to be wrong and that it will be corrected over time, I need a position now. I should probably still have a position. Then building that, I think, is a really, really valuable skill. And the first time you try to do that, it is ridiculously hard. So if you can get help, whether that's through therapy or whether that's through a trusted advisor that you have a trusted mentor or someone that you think, I mean, if in the case of, like, for example, we're a Jedi community. So in the Master Padawan relationship, if you find that valuable to you to help you get through that, then that's great. The only position to be wary of is having your beliefs given to you by someone else without analysis, mm-hmm. or going where I have no beliefs and therefore, or I have no conviction. And even though you know that your beliefs are going to be wrong, you still operate with conviction, if for no other reason than to learn how they're wrong and how to change them. Mm-hmm. I think that it's important to do that. I do also want to call out that I have about 10 minutes left. So if there's any particular subject we want to hit on that we haven't covered yet, I'd really like to make sure we get to that.
Let's say we covered beliefs, value, the experience. Now the perception part. I don't think we've touched on that as much, but at some point, you know, I would like to cover it as much as we can, but however, we can always come back and revisit that. We can always continue this to another time, which is the beauty about this stuff. Now, what would be your perception on all of this?
The role of perception comes in two forms. There's observable perception, and then there's the way it immediately comes to mind is it takes two forms. One is the observable perception. So it's just neutral perception. I am mm-hmm. observing something without any kind of emotional engagement. And so I see the sky is blue. Great. Mm-hmm. I don't have any emotional conviction there. I'm not, you know, invested in the sky being a different color. So, okay, I can make a relatively neutral observation. So that's perception in raw form. But then there is we have a tendency to fill in gaps. It's mm-hmm. a beautiful survival mechanism. It works out very, very well for us. and it keeps us alive in a lot of ways. The problem is it's a short circuit in the brain that removes critical analysis. Yes. And so we rush to conclusions by short circuiting a bunch of logical associations that need to happen. And the way that we short circuit, or the areas of focus that we're going to see, are going to be those that are most closely aligned or relevant to our belief structure, either for or against. We like things that reinforce our beliefs, and we're always watching out for things that undermine and challenge our beliefs. So we will see those. But those are two of 57 other things that had nothing to do with our beliefs. And we didn't see the other 57 because they neither reinforced nor challenged.
Yeah.
And we weren't actively looking for anything. And so the piece on perception is, understand that you are always perceiving through a filter. And if you have an understanding of your beliefs and an awareness that those beliefs affect the filter, that you can maybe have a chance at clearing it up. I mean, my example of looking for different information sources for me is me attempting to actively set aside my filter. I still dismiss certain things that I observe because of they're too far beyond what my ability to sustain my filter can do. They're that road too far, but I'm trying to make it so that road too far, I can push further into that uncomfortable area to try to be able to perceive things in ways that are foreign to me, ways that may be contrary to my belief and value system. So I actively make an effort here, but I don't think a lot of people do. But I think it's something that would be very valuable if they did. I think that but recognizing that your observations are very, especially your memory of them, is malleable. Your memory of your observations is definitely fallible. We know this. I mean, there's been lots of studies done on it. My favorite one is the 9/11 case where the Twin Towers situation on 9/11/2001. People were asked to write down their memory of the event the day after it happened. And then 6 months ago, they were asked to write down their memory of it after of what happened. And then they were given both copies, and everyone was shocked that the way that they had written down the day after was very different than the way they had written it down 6 months later. And they were absolutely convinced that the one that they had written the day after was the wrong one.
Wow.
So the human mind is not a reliable, the human memory is not reliable. It's malleable. And it's malleable in association with your value and belief system. So you can use that. If you're very clever, you can actually use that to your advantage. But in most cases, we don't actively use it at all. A lot of people don't even know it happens. And so we just assume that our memory is accurate, and then we go with it. And that becomes the way that we live our life. So I think that recognizing that your perception, especially your analysis of perception, when it's like ascribing intent to behavior or ascribing the unseen from the seen, the reasons why things that we see happen, I think that is very fallible and very heavily influenced by what we want to be true.
Okay.
And so if you can keep that in mind and somehow keep that neutral, which I don't think is actually possible, but we can try, and we can get much closer to neutrality than what we do when we don't try.
Yes.
I think that we can do that. The scientific method makes an effort to give us tools by which to remove as much of that objectivity as possible. But in things like the social sciences, that's impossible. So there aren't very good tools to where we can get to like the same level of infallibility that we can get to in physics. It's just not, we still have to go with generalities, and we have to go with you know, different forms of valid test structures to try to get as close as we can. But it's really difficult to get to a point of absolute, you know, neutral observation. So these, I think when we're doing it personally, as in our day-to-day lives, we don't have the scientific, unless we're trained in scientific thinking explicitly, it's very difficult to have those tools available to you on your own.
Yeah.
And in fact, our legal system doesn't work in a purely scientific approach. It actually can't function that way in certain contexts. It relies on the human perception of that.
Yes.
And that's why we try to mitigate that. In the French system, you try to mitigate it by having three judges who are highly trained in critical analysis. In our system, for some cases, we operate with a jury of 12, where we try to ensure that we reconcile all 12, so we get that diversity of different perceptions and intentions.
Yes.
So these are challenging things. I mean, this is a challenging way to engage with life and a way to perceive life. But that perception, if we're aware that we're fallible, if we're aware that we're perceiving things in alignment with our beliefs and value structures, or in either it reinforces or it takes away from, both will highlight in the brain. It's like both will light up.
Yes.
So you'll be dialed into seeing the things that you're looking for.
Yeah.
Either for or against. It affects our perception. To perceive in absolute neutrality may not be possible. I don't know.
Yeah. So, Miles, I know you have to go, but I want to say thank you again. This is always, always a pleasure. It holds great conversation, and that I would like to do this again at some point when you're maybe have more time, and maybe we can extend out this discussion, this talk in this cast. But again, Miles, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk.
It's always a pleasure. I always get something from this. And that, again, thank you. And that this has been I believe, a very productive discussion this time, more so than in the past. And I hope that things go well for you in your endeavors. So, Miles, thank you. You have a good week. I hope things that are productive for you. Take care.
And I wish you and everyone watching a very, very good week.
You too, man. Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.